As described in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, a werewolf, noun, is a person transformed into a wolf or capable of assuming a wolf's form. Werewolf, or man-wolf, was first recorded in Old English in the 11th century in the ecclesiastical ordinances of King Canute between the years of 1017 and 1037 as a synonym for the devil. The terms lycanthropia and lycanthropus didn't make their appearance in the English language until 1584 in the anti-witch hunting book The Discoveries of Witchcraft by Reginald Scott. During the Inquisition, lycanthropy and werewolfism were used interchangeably. Of course, werewolf lore predates all of this by thousands of years. Widely accepted as being the first story of a werewolf transformation in history takes place in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which was written between 2150 and 1400 BCE. Gilgamesh was the son of a king and a goddess, making him partially divine and probably one of the most well-known heroes from ancient Mesopotamian mythology. In this particular tale, Ishtar, the goddess of fertility, love, and war, fell in love with Gilgamesh. Despite her flirtatious advances, though, he turned her away. In the past, a young shepherd who had fallen for Ishtar showed his love and devotion by leaving offerings at a shrine devoted to her. Once she was bored of the human, she turned him into a wolf, and he was then killed and torn apart by his own hounds. Now, while this story might not have a lot of the same qualities as modern tales of werewolves or lycanthropy, it is the earliest recorded telling of any such transformation. Werewolf folklore spans across many cultures, and in almost all of the tales told, we find two main categories, voluntary and involuntary. Voluntary meaning they can take on the change at will, usually by gaining some sort of magical ability or donning an enchanted item. Involuntary, obviously meaning they have no choice in the matter, such as a curse or a punishment. Today's episode is going to be the first in a series covering werewolves, shapeshifters, lycanthropes, and other corresponding creatures. The belief of these creatures is commonplace throughout the world, from ancient Greek and Roman culture to Native American folklore to the widespread belief of werewolves in Europe, such as France and Germany, the locations of the two stories I'm going to be covering in today's episode. While both of these are fairly common tales when it comes to the topic of werewolves, they are important when it comes to understanding not only the nature of the beast, but the nature of mankind as well. Between the years of 1764 and 1767, a beast terrorized the people of Gévaudan in southern France, located in the modern-day province of Languedoc and most of Lozère. The beast was described as being wolf-like, but with some traits that made it seem like an altogether different creature. I have read a compendium of articles and pages on the Beast of Gévaudan, and many of the details of exactly what or how things happened differ slightly with each telling, but there are also a lot of points that remain static, and those are the ones I want to focus on. Now keep in mind, eyewitness testimonies aren't always reliable at the best of times, and hysteria was definitely a factor. This beast, or even beasts, was estimated to kill between 60 and 100 people, and even more had encounters or close calls. The people of Gévaudan were no stranger to wolves and their appearance in rural southern France at this time. This beast was said to be much too large to be a regular wolf, closer to the size of a donkey. It had an elongated muzzle, an extremely wide chest, and long body. Its ears were small and straight, its gaping mouth was full of large, sharp teeth, it had long fur that was reddish in color with black stripes, and it even had a tail that was longer than that of a regular canine. The Beast of Gévaudan was also said to be able to walk on its hind legs and even repel bullets. The first recorded sighting of the beast was that of a young woman who was tending to a herd of cattle in June 1764. The creature who she described as, quote, like a wolf, yet not a wolf, did have wolf-like qualities, but as I just described, it also had some very unwolf-like traits as well. Luckily for this would-be victim, her cattle charged the animal and it ran back to the woods from where it had came. Only 1 month later, a 14-year-old girl shepherding a flock of sheep would be the beast's first known victim. It is said that when she was found, her heart had been ripped from her body. The attacks continued through summer and autumn, and more children and teens were killed. Victims were found with their throats or hearts ripped out, their faces torn off, and/or their bodies mutilated. Clearly, these were the acts of something savage and violent, and it didn't end there. Bounties were offered, and hunters would search the woods and countryside in search of the elusive beast. One hunting party was said to track it down and even shoot the creature, only to have it run off after being hit. In January of 1765, the beast attacked a 10-year-old boy and his friends. These boys did not sit idle and allow the beast to carry on with killing them. No, these young boys fought back and eventually drove the beast away. Around this time, France was at the tail end of the Seven Years' War, and the press had done nothing but report on the war for years. The attacks in Gévaudan gave them something else to talk about, and the news spread quickly. The news of the beast and the bravery of the boys eventually reached the French government, and they were rewarded by King Louis IX with an education paid for by the crown. There was now a royal bounty on the creature's head, and a cavalry unit was dispatched to destroy the beast of Gévaudan. In September that same year, a very large wolf was indeed shot and killed by one of the king's gunbearers, and this was believed to be the beast responsible for the killings. No sooner did the cavalry leave, and the attacks began again. This time, however, the people would receive no help from their government. Lured by the large reward, hunters continued to seek out the creature responsible. While it took some time and many more deaths, the beast was eventually shot and killed by none other than silver bullets. The animal was dissected, and inside of its stomach were in fact human remains from a little girl who had died just one day before. The beast was then paraded around before being sent to the king for proof that the beast was finally, once and for all, killed. Drawings depicting the beast of Gévaudan at that time do indeed show something seemingly unique. While the beast of Gévaudan might easily be understood to not be an actual werewolf in our modern times, people living through the terror that gripped southern France in the years between 1764 and 1767 did believe it was and referred to the beast as a loup-garou, or werewolf. With its unwolf-like characteristics, its ability to elude hunters for so long, the weird way in which it attacked humans while leaving the livestock alone, the manner of the killings, reports of the beast walking on its hind legs, and of course the fact that it was silver bullets that finally brought the beast down, it's easy to see how the people would believe the creature possessed supernatural abilities like that of a werewolf. Of course, there are a number of theories as to what the identity of the beast actually was. Because the people of France at the time weren't familiar with animals like, say, a subadult male lion or a hyena, if they were responsible like some people think, how would the people know what to call them or how to describe them? Could it have been a serial killer? Or perhaps maybe it was a werewolf after all? We will probably never know for sure what the beast of Gévaudan that attacked and terrorized southern France in the 18th century was, but history doesn't refute that these events took place and something quite strange was killed. Now, fair warning, things are about to get kind of weird. The next one I'm going to talk about is none other than the werewolf of Bedburg, Peter Stump. This is truly an infamous case when it comes to the world of werewolf lore. The most detailed source of this case was a pamphlet of 16 pages translated from German that was published in London in 1590. The German format has no surviving copies known to history, and there are only two copies of the English translation in existence today, one of which is in the British Museum and the other in the Lambeth Library, both of which are located in London. The details in this case are kind of lacking, but seeing as it happened so long ago, and resources to information are limited, I will do my best with what I have. Peter Stump was born in 1535 near Bedburg, Germany. The exact date and place that he was born is unknown, because the local church registers were destroyed during the Thirty Years' War. In addition, not too much is really known about Peter's younger years. What we do know is mostly from his confession. Prior to his arrest in 1589, Peter Stump was a wealthy and successful farmer in his community. He had two children, a son and a daughter. He was also a widower, and while he later had a mistress, they were never married. At some point in his lifetime, his left hand had been cut off. The werewolf responsible for the murders of livestock and humans alike for decades was allegedly missing its front left forepaw, which, to the people of Bedburg at the time, was only further proof of Peter Stump's guilt. Peter was accused of serial murder, cannibalism, witchcraft, incest, and werewolfery. Upon being threatened with torture, he provided a confession of his crimes. In his account, he said that he had been practicing black magic since he was 12 years old and claimed that the devil himself had given him a magical belt that allowed him to transform into, quote, the likeness of a greedy devouring wolf, strong and mighty, with eyes great and large, which in the night sparkled like fire. A mouth great and wide, with most sharp and cruel teeth, a huge body and mighty paws. He was able to remove the belt and return to his human form. However, no such belt was ever discovered after his arrest. Maybe due to his diligence or loyalty, the devil also sent a succubus for him to fornicate with. This part of the confession only furthered his guilt of witchcraft. Stump had also confessed that for 25 years he devoured the flesh of goats and lambs or sheep, as well as humans. He admitted to eating at least 14 children and 2 pregnant women. One of the 14 children Peter Stump had killed and eaten was his own son. The fetuses of the pregnant women he apparently ripped from the womb and, quote, ate their hearts panting hot and raw, which he later described as being dainty morsels. In addition to all of this, Stump not only had an incestuous relationship with his daughter, but at one point, another distant relative as well. While we know that he also had a mistress, I'm not really sure what her role was in all of this. Obviously, due to his confession, Peter Stump was found guilty and executed along with his daughter and mistress on October 31st, 1589. Peter Stump's execution was brutal. He was placed on a torture wheel and his flesh was then torn from his body in at least 10 places with red-hot pincers, followed by the flaying of his limbs. After this ordeal, his limbs were then broken with the blunt side of an axe head, apparently to prevent him from returning from the grave. The breaking and flaying happened while he was still very much alive, of course. He was then finally beheaded and burned on a pyre along with his daughter and mistress, who had already been flayed and strangled. To send a message and warning to would-be offenders and future werewolves, the local authorities erected a pole, adding a figure of a wolf, the wheel which Peter Stump was tortured and executed on, and for even more dramatic effect, they placed his severed head atop the pole. The case of Peter Stump and the Werewolf of Bedburg took place in a time where the hunting of witches and other servants of the devil were commonplace. Around 250 recorded werewolf trials took place between the years of 1423 and 1720. Now that's just the werewolf trials. That's not including the some 26,000 convicted witches that were executed in Germany during those 3 centuries. But that's a story for another time. The point is, belief that flesh and blood humans were consorting with the devil to do his bidding was widely accepted during this time. Religion was high, and let's face it, there wasn't an overwhelming amount of understanding when it came to mental health, and even if there was, science and the church weren't exactly coexistent. Even in our modern era, we are only beginning to understand the many different layers of mental illness. Clinical lycanthropy is a rare condition in which someone truly believes they are transforming, have transformed, or are currently a wolf or wolf-like animal. There is a broader term called zoanthropy, which refers to all manner of believed animal metamorphosis. There have been reports of people believing to have been transformed into foxes, hyenas, cats, birds, frogs, and even bees. But since our topic today was werewolves, I'm going to stick with lycanthropes. Clinical lycanthropy does not refer to a physical change in appearance, but as far as someone who is affected by the condition is concerned, the transformation is very real, and they will act as a wolf would. For example, someone with clinical lycanthropy might act erratically, growling, howling, walking on all fours, biting or gnawing, attacking both animals and humans alike, or eating raw flesh. Sound familiar? The condition is generally associated with different forms of psychosis, such as, but not limited to, schizophrenia, multiple personality disorder, bipolar disorder, and even depression, and it is believed to be an expression of an already developed form of mental illness. Other factors can include drug use, delirium, trauma to the brain, neurological conditions, and cultural influences. Basically, there are a wide range of possibilities as to why clinical lycanthropy occurs, but since it is more often than not associated with psychotic disorders and mental illness, treatment usually includes antipsychotics, antidepressants, and mood stabilizers. Lycanthropy has been recognized as a medical disorder as far back as the 2nd century when the Greek physician and philosopher Galen considered it to be a, quote, melancholic disease with delirium. Of course, this would make it possible that many cases of what we consider werewolves today might not be so supernatural after all. Perhaps the Beast of Gévaudan was in fact just an animal that people in France at the time had little to no previous knowledge of. Or maybe it was some crazy hybrid that hasn't been seen since. And maybe Peter Stump suffered from mental illness and really had clinical lycanthropy, and the superstitious people of Germany at the time simply didn't know any better. But on the other hand, what if science can't always explain it away? These are only 2 accounts of stories from Europe that have been part of werewolf lore for centuries. But don't worry, there's plenty more to explore, and some of it is far more unexplainable. As I said in the beginning of this episode, this is going to be a series, but I don't want to burn either myself or the handful of listeners I have out on this particular topic, so I'm not going to be releasing them consecutively. Just know that more are definitely coming, and there is just simply too much to cover in one episode alone. I have barely even begun to scratch the surface on this topic. I have been your host, Aurora, and this has been The Dark Masquerade. As always, thank you for listening.